episode was a warning to me never to leave her unguarded. 9 days out of Loyangalani, we camped at the northern end of the hills. As usual, we'd sent a party of game scouts ahead to spy out the country and keep a lookout for poachers. Early in the afternoon, they returned and reported seeing a large body of men in canoes. The only tribe on the lake which possesses proper dugout canoes is the Galuba, a turbulent people, well supplied with rifles, who constantly carry out raids from across the Ethiopian border into our territory, looting and murdering. Elsa and I remained in camp with 4 game scouts armed with rifles to protect us, while the rest of the party went off to reconnoitre. When they'd reached the top of a ridge which overlooked the bay, they saw 3 canoes with 12 men on board, close inshore, paddling in the direction of our camp. However, they at once spotted our party, so that by the time George and the other men had reached the water's edge, the canoes were a good 200 yards out, making for a small island and paddling madly. They did not appear to have firearms, though of course they might have had rifles concealed in the canoes. Looking through glasses, George saw at least 40 men on the island and several canoes drawn up on its shore. He watched the canoes reach the beach and an obviously excited group gather round them. Then, since without a boat there was nothing much they could do, the party returned to camp. We packed up at once and moved to the bay below, as close as possible to the island. When dawn broke, we saw that the island was deserted. Evidently, the Galuba had not liked the look of us and had decided to get away during the hours of darkness. Soon after sunup, we saw a multitude of vultures and marabous descending upon the island. This led us to suppose that the Galuba had been on a poaching expedition and had no doubt killed several hippo. At about 11 in the morning, 2 canoes suddenly issued out of a dense belt of reeds and made for open water. To discourage them, George put a few bullets across their bows, which sent them back to the reeds in a hurry. Throughout the day, we could see their heads bobbing above the reeds to inspect us. We estimated that there were 4 canoes in the reeds, probably stragglers. Since it was impossible to reach them, George thought the next best thing was to encourage them to make for home. So as soon as it was dark, he fired tracer bullets and a few very lights at intervals over the swamp. By now, our supplies were running low, and it was time to turn back. Instead of retracing our steps, we decided to take an inland route. Gota, our Turkana guide, did not seem very sure of the way, and what was worse, was not certain whether we should find water when needed. For the region was dependent on waterholes, which at this dry season were few and far between. George, however, calculated that we should never be more than a long day's march from the lake, so if pressed for water, we could make for it. The country here was even more desolate than the one we had passed through on our outward march. There was nothing but lava, so understandably there was little game and no population. Luckily, we had bought sheep at Loyangalani, and though Elsa's living larder was rapidly dwindling away, it was sufficient to solve her feeding problem, but all of us lost most of our surplus weight during this time. In spite of the hardships Elsa had endured on this safari, the bond between us had only been strengthened. As long as she was with us and knew herself to be loved and secure, she was happy. It was very touching to watch her trying to control the strong forces within her and adapt herself to our way of life in order to please us. Her good-natured temperament was certainly due in part to her character, but part too may have come from the fact that neither force nor frustration was ever used to adapt her to our way of life. For we tried by kindness alone to help her to overcome the differences that lie between our 2 worlds. Elsa has charming manners. No matter for how short a time we've been separated, she will greet us ceremoniously, walking from one to the other, rubbing her head against us while meowing in a low moan. Invariably, I come first, then George, followed by Nuru. and whoever happens to be near is afterwards greeted in the same way. She knows at once who likes her and reacts affectionately. She tolerates justifiably nervous guests, but those who are really scared have a hard time. Not that she has ever done them any harm, but she delighted in thoroughly terrifying them. After our return from Lake Rudolph, when we took Elsa out for her evening walks, she began to display a growing restlessness. Sometimes she refused to return with us, and she spent the night out in the bush. Usually we succeeded in getting her back by going to fetch her in the Land Rover. In fact, she soon decided that it was a waste of energy to walk home when a car had been specially brought to fetch her, so she would jump onto the canvas roof and loll at her ease, and from this vantage point she would watch out for game as we drove along. This was a very satisfactory arrangement from her point of view, but unfortunately the manufacturers had not designed the roof as a couch for a lioness. As a result, the supports began to give way under the strain, and we found Elsa gradually subsiding on top of us, so George had to rig up extra supports and reinforce the canvas. Elsa was now 23 months old, and her voice broke to a deep growl. She seemed to be in season, and exuded a strong-smelling secretion which she ejected with her urine against certain trees, and although it was her own smell, she always pulled up her nose in disgust at it. Normally she followed us on our walks wherever we went, but now, for 2 days, she determined to cross the valley. On this particular afternoon, she led us in her direction, and we soon found the fresh pug marks of a lion. At dark, she refused to return. As we were near a car track, we went back to get the Land Rover, and George set off while I stayed at home, in case she took the shortcut back. When he reached the place where we had left her, George shouted for her for some time, but there was no response, only the hills echoed his calls. Then, hoping that Elsa had already come home, he returned. I told him there was still no sign of her, so he went back again, and some time after he had gone, I heard a shot. Until he came back, I was very anxious, and then most upset by what he had to tell me. He had driven out and called for a good half hour, but Elsa had not shown up. Then he had stopped the car in an opening in the bush, wondering where to look next. Suddenly, some 200 yards behind the car, there had been a great uproar of lions quarrelling. Then the next moment a lioness flashed by, with another in hot pursuit. As they shot past, George seized his rifle and put a bullet under the second animal, assuming, probably rightly, that she was a jealous lioness bent on Elsa's destruction. Now he'd come to fetch me. We drove back to the scene, but though we called desperately for Elsa, called and called, no familiar sound came in answer. But presently, as if in derision, the lion chorus started up a few 100 yards away. We drove towards them until we could see the glint of 3 pairs of eyes. There was nothing more to be done, so with heavy hearts, we turned for home. Would Elsa be killed by a jealous lioness? In her present condition, she might easily have mated with the lion, and it was a question of whether his lioness would tolerate a rival. However, to our great relief, we'd not gone more than a mile along the track when we came upon Elsa sniffing at a bush. She utterly ignored us. We tried to persuade her to join us, but she remained where we had found her, gazing wistfully into the bush, in the direction in which the lions had last been heard. Presently, they started calling again, and approached. Suddenly Elsa moved towards the lions, and I shouted, "Elsa, no, don't go there, you'll get killed!" Elsa sat down looking at us, and looking back at her own kind, undecided what to do. For an hour the situation did not alter. Then George fired 2 shots over the lions. This had the effect of sending them off in silence. Then, as Elsa still had not made up her mind, we drove slowly back, hoping that she might follow us, and so she did. Very reluctantly, she walked parallel with the car, looking back many times, till finally she hopped onto the roof and we brought her back to safety. What had happened during the 5 hours which Elsa had spent with the lions? Would a wild pride accept her in spite of the human smell which she carried? Would a male ignore a female in season? Why had she returned with us, instead of joining her own kind? Was it because she was frightened of the fierce lioness? The fact remained that she had come to no harm as a result of this experience. From this time onwards, Elsa spent more and more nights away. We tried to induce her to come home by driving near to her favourite places and calling to her. Occasionally she came, more often she did not. Sometimes she was away without food or water for 2 or 3 days. Water was our main hold on her, for this she could only get at the house. But soon the rains were due, and we realised that when the time came we should lose all control of her. This raised a problem which we had to solve. It was one which was made more urgent by the fact that our long overseas leave was due in May. Elsa was now 27 months old, almost full grown. We had always known that we could not keep her free indefinitely at Easyolo. Our original idea had been to send her to join her sisters at the Rotterdam Zoo, and we'd even made the necessary arrangements in case an emergency should arise. But now she had taken her future into her own paws, and her latest developments were decisive in altering our plans for her. Because we'd been so fortunate in bringing her up in her natural environment, and because she seemed so much at home in the bush and was accepted by wild animals, we felt that she might well prove to be the exception to the rule that a pet will be killed by its own kind because of its human smell and ignorance of bush life. To release Elsa back to the wild would be an experiment well worth trying. We intended to spend 2 or 3 weeks with her. Then, if all went well, we would take our long leave. This one is supposed to spend outside Kenya in order to have a change of climate. Next, we had to consider where to release Elsa. Unfortunately, Easyolo was far too populated for us to let her go wild there. But we knew of an area which for most of the year was devoid of inhabitants and livestock, but had an abundance of game, especially lion. We received permission to take Elsa to this place. As the rains were expected any day, we had no time to lose, if she were to reach her possible future home before they began. Before setting off, we took her out for her usual walk to her favourite rocks across the valley from our house. There I photographed her for the last time in her home. She is genuinely camera shy and always hates being filmed or sketched. She invariably turns her head or just walks away. On this last day at Easyolo, she had to endure a lot from our Laika, so finally she took her revenge. When for a moment I left the camera unguarded, she leapt up, sprang upon it and galloped away with it over the rocks. She shook it most provokingly between her teeth, or chewed at it, holding it firmly between her paws. Finally, we recovered it, and miraculously it was not badly damaged. But then all hope of an early start was gone. It was late in the afternoon of the next day before we reached our destination. Our plan was this. We would spend the first week taking Elsa, perched on the roof of the Land Rover, round the new country, thus getting her used to it and to the animals, many of which belong to species which do not live in the northern frontier, and she had therefore never seen. During the second week, we intended to leave her overnight while she was active in the bush, and to visit and feed her in the mornings when she was sleepy. Afterwards, we would reduce her meals in the hope that this would encourage her to kill on her own, or to join a wild lion. On the morning after our arrival, we started our programme. First we took off her collar, as the symbol of liberation. Elsa hopped onto the roof of the Land Rover, and we went off. After only a few hundred yards, we saw a lioness walking parallel to us downhill. We drove closer. Elsa displayed much excitement, jumped off her seat, and making low moaning noises, cautiously followed this new friend. But as soon as the lioness stopped and turned round, her courage failed her, and she raced back as fast as she could to the safety of the car. Next morning, we had better luck. We discovered a young lion resting in the high grass, sunning himself. He was a magnificent young male, with a beautiful blonde mane, and Elsa seemed attracted by him. Just the right husband for her, we thought. We drove to within 30 yards of him. The lion looked mildly surprised when he saw his prospective bride sitting on top of a car, but he responded in a friendly manner. Elsa made low moans, but would not come off the roof. So we drove a little distance away and persuaded her to get down. Then suddenly, we left her and drove round to the other side of the lion. This meant that she would have to pass him in order to reach us. After much painful hesitation, she plucked up enough courage to walk towards the lion. The lion got up and went towards her, with, I am sure, the friendliest intentions. But at the last moment, Elsa panicked and rushed back to the car. We drove away with her, and to induce her to quit her seat, we drove behind a bush. I got out, but was nearly knocked over by a hyena who dashed out of his cool retreat, in which we found a newly killed baby zebra. It was Elsa's feeding time, so regardless of the consequences, she jumped out of the car onto the carcass. We took this opportunity to drive away as fast as we could and left her alone for her night's adventure. Early next morning, anxious to know the outcome of this experiment, we set off to visit. What we found was poor Elsa waiting at the spot at which we had left, but minus the kill. She was overjoyed to see us, and sucked my thumbs frantically to make sure that everything was all right between us. When she'd calmed down and felt safe enough to fall asleep, we decided rather sadly that we must break faith with her again, and we sneaked away. Till now, we'd always given Elsa her meat already cut up, so that she should not associate her food with living animals. Now we needed to reverse our system, so during her midday sleep, we drove 60 miles to shoot a small buck for her. We had to go this distance because no one was allowed to shoot game near the camp. We brought her a complete buck, wondering if she knew how to open it, since she had had no mother to teach her. We soon saw that by instinct she knew exactly what to do. She started on the inner part of the hind legs, where the skin is softest, then tore out the guts, and after enjoying these delicacies, buried the stomach contents and covered up the blood spore, as all proper lions do. Then she gnawed the meat off the bones with her molars and rasped it away with her rough tongue. Once we knew that she could do this, it was time for us to let her do her own killing. The plain was covered with isolated bush clusters, ideal hideouts for any animal. All the lions had to do when they wanted a meal was to wait under cover until an antelope approached, downwind, rush out and get their dinner. We now left Elsa alone for 2 or 3 days at a time, hoping that hunger would make her kill. But when we came back, we always found her waiting for us, and hungry. It was heartbreaking having to stick to our program, when obviously all she wanted was to be with us and sure of our affection. This she showed very clearly by sucking my thumbs and holding on to us with her paws. All the same, we knew that for her good, we must persevere. By now, we realized that it was going to take us much longer to release her to nature than we had expected. We therefore asked the government if we could use our long leave in the country for the purpose of carrying out this experiment, and very kindly they consented. Elsa had not yet started killing for herself. The rains had begun, and every afternoon there were heavy showers. The conditions in this region were very different to those at Isiolo. For one thing, it was much colder. For another, while the ground at Isiolo is sandy and dries within a few hours, here there was black cotton soil, which turns into a morass after rain. At home, Elsa had enjoyed the rains and been invigorated by them, but here she was very miserable. After a few days, the rain decreased, and we renewed our efforts to turn Elsa into a wild lioness. Once she could kill, she would be a more suitable partner for a lion, should she decide to join one. The plains were still underwater, and most of the game had concentrated on the few bits of slightly higher ground which were drier. Elsa loved one little hillock, which was studded with rocks.